and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Emma Gunnar-Wardner, who is a podcaster and runs The Emma Gunns Show. Emma started her career in sales before becoming a journalist and working as beauty editor for OK Magazine for just under a decade. Emma launched her podcast 4 years ago, has had more than 4 million downloads in the last two, and has carved out a community of, in her own words, most excellent listeners.
My name is Emma Gunnar-Wardner, also known as Emma Gunns, and I am a podcaster and broadcaster. I was really distracted at school by Guns N' Roses and the Black Crowes and by wanting to be a backing singer for either or both of them. And so I felt like school got in the way of daydreaming. And as a result, I didn't do very well at school. And so very, very early on, I was told, if you want to become a journalist, which is what I wanted to be, because Lois Lane was a journalist and she went out with Superman. And also, if you think about it, in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, a lot of the chick flicks, a lot of movies, the female protagonists were journalists. And I just think I looked at that and thought, that looks really great. But I was very much told at school, yeah, there's no hope for you because you're That's not horrendous. One of our clever ones. And so I just sort of was like, oh, okay. And I went to university, not because I wanted to, I have to be honest, I went because I thought I had to. And I drove down to the university that I ended up going to, the University of Kent, and went to the undergraduate admissions officer and begged for a place. And my brother had been there before me and he sort of liked the idea of that story. And I read sociology and I can't really remember a huge amount about it because, again, distracted by wanting to be a rock star. And I went into a sales job and I sold computer software over the phone. And I didn't enjoy it. And I remember going to New York on a trip, and it was the first time I'd been away by myself, and just thinking, God, the world's really massive. I can't do this for the rest of my life. And so I quit and I saved up and put myself through an NCTJ journalism diploma and worked on local newspapers for a pittance for a while, because I was, at this age, probably 24, 25. So I'd been out of uni for a little while.
What stories were you covering in the local newspaper? Have you seen Afterlife with Ricky Gervais on Netflix?
No, I'm saving that. I'm saving that for when I need it most, because I know I was writing about fates. I was writing about car accidents. I was writing about council elections.
Did you find that your training ground in the software sales helped you with journalism because you figured out how to get people to give you the quotes that you wanted to?
Oh, that's really interesting. I'd never thought of that. I think it gives you an element of it amplifies any kind of gift of the gab that you have, especially if you're doing it over the phone, so you can't read someone's energy or
gives you a thick skin when they're quite grumpy back.
Yeah. It's nothing like having to then, like, years down the line, speak to a celebrity's agent about trying to get them to do an interview and they're like, no, why would they speak to you? That's a whole different thing. So, I did the postgrad and I had done work experience already in the run-up to all of this at OK Magazine. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch The Big Breakfast and it would get to the news and there'd be a segment at the end of the news that would be entertainment. That was the bit of The Big Breakfast that I lived for. And I just thought, I want to be at the Elle Style Awards. I want to just go into the screen and be at those parties. And so OK was a real doorway to that. And I went back at the end of my diploma because you had to do another placement. And I kept going back and they kept asking me back. And then one time I happened to be there. And way before I was ready, truthfully, I was offered the beauty editor job. It was sort of one of those things of right place, right time, luck, fortune, but kind of going there and doing a good job. And I was there. And so began a 9.5 year stint at that magazine. It was the steepest learning curve when I look back now. But I think I was just so blindly ambitious and naive that I didn't realise it was hard.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah, this is so exciting.
So what did the job entail then over those 9.5 years as beauty editor? As you were interviewing a lot of celebrities, trying to get through agents.
Yeah.
Were you managing a team as well?
No, it was just me solo. So I straddled beauty and also the celebrity. So I would do at the time when I joined, there were two beauty pages. And I would also do the smaller celebrity interviews. So, you know, TV interviews or things like that, you know, like a 4-page fashion feature or, and I'd also write the odd bit of news. And then over the years it went from, I mean, literally 3 months in, I remember, bearing in mind I'd been on local newspapers and then was suddenly on OK as the beauty editor. I was asked to go with the editor and the deputy editor and be their helper at Elton John's white tie and tiara party and take the name on the doors and take names on the door.
Wow.
And that was mental. Because it was like, hello, Mr. Manilow, would you have your picture taken? And, you know, you see people, you'd see celebrities like having a laugh with each other and go, what is this? Like people you didn't know were mates, like having proper banter. And
so is it sort of like the dream job then? Because it's kind of what you...
It was. Yeah. It was definitely a fairy tale. When I look back on it now, like the hustle, like working for local newspapers, I used to do filing for £25 a week for somebody, you know, just to get me to that diploma.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, to get that job, to land that job.
And what did those 9.5 years, what dates were they? When did you start? What year did you start?
Ewan McGregor's birthday, 2003, so March the 31st, until June the 1st, 2012.
And what was the life of magazines kind of looking like at that time as well? What, was there the move to digital? Did you feel like kind of the circulations were going down? Had the pinch started? Were there redundancies?
Yes and no. I think I came in at the end of the way, you know, the real wave of, you know, you'd hear people talk about the photo shoots to the Bahamas that were 10 days long or things like that. I definitely came in towards the end as budgets were getting tighter and tighter, but I was working on a title that was wealthy and did have the high-priced magazine exclusive. So for me, I don't think it was until really near the end of my time there that I really understood how much of a pinch there was. But our circulation was really, really, really healthy. It was one of the best-selling magazines. So we never really felt that. But there would be rounds of redundancies because I think everybody always looks to streamline at some point. You know, there's always a cycle of, oh, it's that time of year again. They're going to see if anyone will take a redundo package.
What were those like exclusive interview? Like, is that kind of like £1 million wedding deals and stuff?
I never really worked on the contract side of it, so I don't really understand. I actually probably know as much as anyone who read the magazines. But yeah, I mean, I was around when Katie Price and Peter Andre got married, various footballers. I missed the Beckham stuff. But it was all just really, it was really exciting. And I do remember I was one of the journalists who covered Katie and Peter's wedding. And I remember being in the hotel the morning of and turning on like the news. And then there were like the children's entertainment programs on a Saturday morning. And they were all talking about it and just having this moment of, wow, like, I'm going to that today. And it, everyone's talking about it. Like it's such a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, but it was just very exciting and glossy and as exactly as I'm sure you'd imagine it would be.
When was the first time that you became aware of social media and what were the first platforms you joined?
It was probably Twitter, and I think I started my Twitter under a different name actually. I can't even remember what that name was, but it was to do with beauty and being on the magazine. And I think I just used to like, oh, I painted my nails and do a picture. but I certainly didn't use it to drive traffic to my content, which is obviously what I entirely use it for these days.
Yeah. When was the first time that you became aware of, you know, creators and influencers and people making a living purely through digital and these platforms?
Honestly, it probably wasn't until after I left magazines. I think because the magazine world can be a bit of a bubble, and I definitely was in a bubble in the title that I worked on.
Did you move to go freelance?
Yes. Yeah. So I took a voluntary redundancy package because I had been there for such a long time and I had definitely outgrown the role and wanted to move. But I had always dreamed that I would move around within the industry. And my goal was always to be the beauty director on a monthly. And those opportunities just weren't coming my way. And I remember even if they were coming off on weeklies, you know, like the more prestigious weeklies that are sort of like weeklies that are glossy monthlies, it would be, but you're from a tabloid. And so I felt like there were just too many barriers to entry to even move around within this space that I felt really comfortable in. It was quite weird.
Was that quite a stressful period of time then?
Frustrating, because you know that thing of, well, I know I'm capable and I know that if you throw me in at the deep end, which is what happened at OK, I know I'll swim. I know that curve is something I'm really good at dealing with, but someone has to give you an opportunity. And I think what's brilliant about what's evolved with social media is being able to create your own opportunity.
Yeah. So when did you first start creating something in the digital? I know that you were interested in YouTube at one point.
Yeah, I dabbled in YouTube, and I think from a very arrogant place, I dabbled in YouTube because, again, I wasn't really 100% aware of what was going on YouTube, if I'm completely honest. But I remember seeing an advert, I think it was during X Factor or something, and there was an advert for YouTube, and I think it featured Zoella.
In 2016.
That sounds a bit late.
It's kind of that outdoor campaign. Maybe it was 2015.
No, it must have been a bit earlier than that. It must have been about 2012. I saw something. Anyway.
Yeah.
And I just thought, And I sort of picked a little bit at it and thought, well, hang on. This person's talking about beauty, getting a load of sponsorship. And it wasn't just Zoella, because I think Zoella's content's actually brilliant. But and I thought, well, hang on a minute. I mean, I'm a beauty editor who's worked with all of these brands, who's got all of these connections. Maybe I can create something that sort of straddles the two spaces, sort of like fun and informal, but with a bit more of a connection to the industry. And it was really, really arrogant of me, because actually it's not about your connections. It's about being able to create really good content that is engaging and actually helps people. So, but I did, one of the things somebody told me very early on is never take advice from somebody who hasn't failed in the arena in which they are now successful in.
That's a good quote to live by.
Yeah, so I take that on the chin and go, you know, it was fairly under the radar, got to screw up and really like mess up. And
yeah. So did you just not get the views that you were expecting? Like, did you imagine that you would be?
Literally no one cared, because you can't just start a YouTube channel these days, or even at that point, and just expect if you build it, they will come. Because I think it had evolved from that point. I think the earlier YouTubers obviously could do that because it was a new platform that people were discovering and algorithms were different and what have you. But I think at the point that I went into it, you had to have more of a purpose. And I think that's crucial for anybody creating any kind of content. It's like, what's your purpose? And if it's to make money or for people to like me, then think of another one maybe.
Do you think that your viewpoint is sort of testament to how journalists in general look at influencers?
No, I can only speak for me. I don't know what other people think. And
there has been a bit of resistance. I know there was the Vogue article about how influencers were sort of the death of Fashion Week a few years ago. And every so often, there are quite a lot of negative articles about influencers in mainstream press.
Yeah, and there was another one specifically aimed at beauty that was written, that was featured in Cosmopolitan about, are they destroying your skin or something? And look, what we have to remember is that magazines are trying to create an engaging story, and sometimes that means going down a path that might be a bit sensationalist or a bit inaccurate. Oh, she gets nervous. But
especially when you're kind of wanting the clicks, because people know that those audiences are engaged and are going to defend. So I do feel that online particularly, it'll be like, let's hit the influencers, and then, you know, we're going to get the clicks.
I can only talk about my perspective. And I think when I first probably started being approached about influencers, or kind of getting the idea of it, was the tail end of when I was on the magazine. And I remember another journalist saying to me, but they're not trained writers, blah, blah, blah. And I remember parroting that the next time I spoke to somebody and saying, yeah, but they're not trained writers. They don't know anything about the industry. They don't know this. They don't know the other. And it's really easy to build up, because that's a pretty solid wall to build up against somebody. But actually, it's like with anything. But what do they have? Because they are doing something, right? So let's not think about what they don't have. Let's see what they do have. Mm. And maybe focus on that a little bit. So yes, I would be lying if I said I wasn't dismissive of content creators as we know them now when I first heard about them, because I was in this cushy magazine land that was never going to go anywhere.
Who were the first influencers that you actually met? And who are the influencers that you kind of look to now and think that they've done a stellar job?
I think probably the first influencers were probably Sam and Nick that I met on the beauty scene.
And they were trained makeup artists. That's where they sort of started as well.
And I cannot say enough how much time I have for those two women. I really cannot. As professionals and also as friends, I think they are flipping amazing. I mean, since then, I've met so many people like Estée Lalonde, who I think creates amazing content. Alex Light straddles both worlds, because she's got a really popular blog. She's got IG, but she's also on a magazine.
So you try YouTube and it doesn't work out. How do you start your podcast, which is, you know, massive? Can you tell me a bit about your podcast as well?
I can tell you how it started. It came out of the fact that I went freelance and I had worked on a magazine where I hadn't ever really had to flex my feature writing muscles. It was all interviews and long introductions, and the beauty features were quite snappy, quite newsy, more about price and just giving you top line. So when it came to freelancing and then trying to write features, I just didn't have those muscles and I wasn't good at it. And you begin to feel the pinch very quickly when you go freelance and you can't make money from the thing that you think that you can do. So I went into consulting a bit more and I did a bit of presenting. But I just got to the point where I thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm not making any money and I'm failing. Like, there's no two ways about it. And aside from that, there were some other things going on in my personal life. And I've been bumbling along and I began to get depressed. And eventually I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety, but I just felt really, really lost. And I remember sitting with my friend Charlotte and just saying, I'm really worried now. I don't know what to do. Like, I spent all this money. I invested a lot of time, effort and money and energy into the YouTube channel that didn't ever do anything. And I just didn't have the resources to sort of really pick myself up financially, emotionally, mentally. And I was sort of feeling sorry for myself and being the victim and saying, you know what, Charlotte, I think I'm going to have to move home, go and live with my parents and just kind of call this a day. This has been fun. I went to Elton John's house twice. I met Bette Midler. Like, I can go and work in a coffee shop where my parents live and tell that story every single morning as I froth lattes. And, you know, that'll be a good life. And she was just like, right, Emma, we have to have a conversation. You can go out tomorrow and you can go and froth the best coffee on your doorstep. You can go and make money. You can go and work on a benefit counter. You can go. Don't ever, ever. And she was really strong with me. She was like, don't ever come to me and tell me that you can't make a living. Don't be such a pathetic wuss. And actually, that thing of sort of taking my eye off the world that I had known and realizing there was so much more out there gave me the perspective to try something new. And I wanted to try the podcast because I was listening to Tim Ferriss a lot at that time, and I felt like where I was really struggling to be positive or even have any sense of direction or anything, I just felt like that was the only resource I got where I felt like I was understood. Like, he's been there, he's telling me how to hack the system and to kind of beat the odds, and please, I want to beat the odds. And I got a lot of inspiration from that, so the podcast really came out of listening to those types of podcasts. And it was an opportunity for me, as somebody who was struggling and really needed some guidance, to sit in front of people within the beauty industry who I really admired and get them to tell me how they became successful so that I could. So it's quite selfish, really. But I just really needed mentors. And so I just put myself in front of them and said, "And this is a podcast," which you still have to explain to people. I'm sure you've got that. "And can I ask you some questions about how you built your business and your brand and what challenges you faced?" And that's how it began.
Did you imagine that it would get to the levels of success that it hasn't? How long has it been going now? Like,
it'll be 4 years in April.
Yeah.
So it'll be over, it's just over 350 episodes now.
And do you still love doing it as much as you did at the beginning?
That's such a good question. And you know, when I think when I started on magazines, because it was a fairy tale, I thought that it should feel like one. And it never did. It looked great. And I knew it should feel great, but it never did. And I'm not saying that with podcasting, there aren't days when I think, oh, I don't think that interview went as well as it could have done. Or, oh, I'm not saying there aren't frustrations. But yeah, I definitely feel like I found the thing that I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I think podcasts and just recording them in general, it's such a nice sort of therapeutic, calm way. And I think we're in an age now where everything can be so short and like sharp and we've got to get this done, and actually it's nice to sit, and then in the same way it is to actually listen to a conversation and have your attention on something for a longer kind of period of time, as opposed to just the scroll. We live in a scrolling life, so it's nice to sit down and actually listen. In terms of statistics, like around podcasting, I was talking about this actually on an episode earlier, the retention rates on podcasting are particularly high. Is there kind of, are there any stats around podcasts that you know that you think might be interesting? Not of yours, like personally, but that it is proven to be. Do you have anything around that?
I think, well, I always look to the US when I look at podcast stats or any kind of analytics, because they are ahead of us in terms of how well it is being received. It's a much bigger cultural, I mean, podcasts are huge over in the States, and we are following suit. So I always tend to really look there. And I think the thing that I have used most recently is where I've had an interest from brands who want a brand owner to come on and talk about themselves or talk about their brand or whatever it might be. It's much easier for me to demonstrate the value of a podcast if I use stats from America.
Yeah.
And I can say, this is how much money was spent on advertising in the US last year on podcasts. It's however many times more than it is on print media. This is why. And yeah, that's the sort of stat I would say around podcasting that
I find helpful. When brands come to you about sort of advertising on the podcast, what type of advertising kind of happens? So is it sort of like a 30-second ad intro at the beginning, or is it actually sort of advertorial, I suppose, episode where you're actually interviewing?
Both. So there are both. But I think whatever I do in terms of any content where obviously it's in collaboration with somebody, it has to be something that I would use myself, do myself, or believe in.
Yeah.
And I've always been really rigid about that from day one.
Yeah.
So if someone approaches me and says, can we do something? I'd be like, absolutely not. There's no way that person or that product is coming anywhere near my listeners, because I care about my listeners too much. And it would really annoy me.
Would things be across, we'd like to advertise across 5 episodes at the beginning? Is that like something? So if you have a kind of an ad that sits in and then we want to have 10 episodes that will be with that branded message at the beginning.
So there are 2 different things here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I publish through Acast.
Yeah. So how does that work then? They spot ads in, because I'm with Audioboom and I know that they can put ads in and then you have the kind of commercial breaks, and then there are the read throughs where you would be doing it in your own voice.
Yeah. So listeners will probably be really aware of the pre-roll ads, the mid-roll ads and the post-roll. So I don't open my mid-roll, not for no man, because I don't want my content to be interrupted. And immediately, that's a really lucrative advertising spot. Immediately, that takes you away from earning money.
Yeah.
But I will not open that mid-roll, because
I do find that very distracting when I am listening to an episode.
I don't like it in other shows, and I don't want to do that to my listeners. If I've got somebody on, like I sometimes interview clinical psychologists, or if I've got a doctor on talking about something really intense, or I've got a therapist on talking about what the experience of being in therapy is like, or we're doing an educational piece about retinol and its impact on the skin, or whatever it might be, you don't want to hear an advert. I'm really quite rigid about that.
Yeah.
And probably doesn't make me particularly popular in some circles. So yeah, you've got your pre-roll and your post-roll. So when you are with, as you are with Audioboom, you publish through their back end, and then they get to manipulate what goes on either side. But if a brand comes to me and they say, do you want to tell a story about a particular product or what have you, then that's something that is more editorialized and is what I've done on the magazine for years.
Yeah.
And so, but again, I'll never do an episode with a brand about a product if I think it's just a hard sell. I think, well, what can the listener get out of it? Because as much as I love doing the podcast, I do make it for my listeners.
Yeah.
And I listen really closely to what they want.
And listeners are obviously key to the success of the podcast. And in the same way I was interviewing an influencer, it's like, take on a wrong brand deal, it's actually more risk to me than it is the brand if it goes wrong, because then I'm going to alienate my community.
Yeah.
And you can move on and place that elsewhere, but this is what I have built, in your case, you know, 4 years growing.
Yeah.
With your community, how do you kind of cultivate and look after and communicate with your audience? Do you have like a Facebook group? Do you newsletter? Yeah,
I have a closed Facebook group that there are 3 questions that you have to answer to join. You have to agree to the forum rules. And I'm pretty good at getting back to DMs on Instagram, but the Facebook group's got around 4,000 people and just under. And right when I started it, I said, it's just a safe space for us to continue the conversations that we've already started on the podcast. And again, I always call my listeners my most excellent listeners, because I'm just like, they're just so flipping brilliant. And it has been nothing but, it really is the best of social media. And social media can be a horrible place, but if ever I feel triggered on any social media platform, I will go into that Facebook group. And people are having really intelligent conversations or sharing really interesting insights that are of use to other members within the group. And I love it so much.
And in terms of value, I think that in the kind of digital space, we get a bit obsessed with kind of vanity metrics. And, you know, I've got 100,000 YouTube subscribers, say, but actually 4,000 people within a Facebook group who are communicating and engaging and debating stuff that has been, are clearly engaged in a different way than somebody that maybe clicked a button 5 years ago. Does that ever frustrate you when you're trying to educate, say, a brand on value? What's your process on that?
I think being annoying at school has given me great grounding for just never knowing what it's like to not be popular. So I'm very happy to just now swim in that narrow channel. Do you know what I mean? Of, it's really easy to chase numbers, and I see the benefits. A lot of my friends have huge numbers and I see the benefits of it. And they have all, I hasten to say, grown their audience organically and on merit and completely deserving of it. But I think I came into it at a point where I could have gone for... I could go for follows and likes, but the quality of the content is so much more important to me, and making sure that I'm taking my audience with me, like I'm growing my audience. So when I started, I was really open about the fact that I had depression, I was really struggling, and I feel like I'm out the other side of it, but you never stop dealing with it. Like, you know, it's always kind of in the background. So I'm always really mindful of making sure that we check in on those subjects, because people find those shows, and I'll get emails now, like even yesterday, somebody saying, just listen to the episode you did with Sam Chapman about depression. Because of that, I've booked an appointment to see my doctor. So you've always got to be mindful about sort of moving the story forward, like, but also making sure you're staying true to what started it off and making sure that your listeners are catered for, but it's not static.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of diving into the Facebook group if you have been triggered from other platforms. What platforms do you personally find the most triggering?
I don't find platforms triggering, I find people triggering.
Yeah, well, the people that frequent the platforms. Do you have experience of being kind of trolled?
Touch wood, no. I mean,
we saw the Sally Hughes last year, that there was a whole thread about
that
her.
That was horrendous. For the record, Sally is a really professional, highly intelligent woman, and that shouldn't have happened to her. I felt really bad seeing that.
What are your policies? Like, do you block and mute, or do you just... time you spend on social media, does that impact you? Do you have rules on...
Well, when you're creating your living on social media and you're directing people to... It's really hard to sort of say, well, I'll only do 4 hours a day or however many hours a day. I'm really lucky in that I haven't had anyone be really nasty. I haven't had anyone come into my comments and say anything vile. Please don't see this as an invitation. I really don't want it. And if anyone does come in, like I posted about my breast reduction in December, and it was about 4 months after the surgery. And I said, right, I'm telling this story now. And somebody came in and said, I was really unhappy about the language that you use to describe your old breasts. And I acknowledged that I could see why it would upset her. I totally understood, but I hope she didn't mind me using my platform to talk in a way that I felt comfortable. And I feel like as long as you can, what she said was reasonable. She was triggered by it. It did make her unhappy. And I didn't want to do that to anybody. But equally, you've got to find a happy place. I really, really hear you. And I am sorry that that happened. I completely understand. I've been in your shoes, but this just felt right for me. And I hope you don't mind me using my platform. And if somebody minds, they have the option to leave.
Yeah.
But I hope she didn't. And I hope that she understood that the purpose of that, to talk about it, wasn't to go, look what I did. It was to do, right, this was scary as anything. If you're considering this, this is what to expect. Because it has to be about the listener. My experience is helpful, but also my journalistic experience of being able to then build that story so that somebody gets a really robust resource to know what to expect if they're having any kind of cosmetic surgery is the thing.
And I think there's a difference between people feeding back constructively than people just shouting at you. You know, if someone's done something, say on the street, that you don't like, you're not going to just come up and shout, but excuse me, this is just, you know, what's happened. You're far more likely to listen than...
Yeah, and I do think that's what social media has become. And I just sometimes, like, even I see some of my friends get trolled, and I see someone comment, if someone puts a picture up, someone might say, comment on their physical appearance in a really cruel way. And I just think you wouldn't go up to someone in the street and shout that at them.
Anonymity sometimes brings out the worst in human nature.
Yeah, it's a very funny space. I think what happens a lot after that is I got a lot of accounts with like one square, or like a lot of guys coming in going hi, and I just delete immediately. It's like, no thanks, I know what this is. This is not a real account or anything like that.
If someone was thinking about starting a podcast, your podcast is now how you make your living, and you can financially how does that work then? Is podcasting, in terms of, you know, you are a freelancer, that makes up the most of your income? If, say, someone wanted to start a podcast and wondered if you could make a living, it is possible to make a living through a podcast.
Again, it's a really difficult thing because it's like being in a bubble. So it's not like podcasters get together and chat, because we're all pretty much self-employed, doing our own thing, creating our own content, and we don't like get together and go, how's that? I mean, I have my podcasting buddies, but not very many, because we're all sort of all over the place.
Yeah.
So I can only go on my experience. But, and Sam Chapman always says this, and she says, if you go into anything now, if you start anything to make money, it's not the reason to start it. And I think because I had that experience with YouTube and I felt burned in many ways by it, I didn't go into the podcast actually with that in mind. It was at the back of my mind of this would be really nice, but I almost had parked it for 18 months. I thought, well, I'm going to keep doing it. And I have consistently put out an episode a week for 4 years nearly. But I almost parked the expectation of it making any money, because I just thought, actually, I just need to do this. And maybe from this, I thought I would then get commissions to write, or I would then get consultancy opportunities. So actually, the fact that the podcast was monetizable after a certain point wasn't as much of a game plan as it might have appeared. I definitely thought there was a white space, and I definitely thought people should be podcasting, but I wasn't particularly strategic about it.
Has the podcast led you to get other opportunities, like speaking and things?
Yeah. I think people now trust me to host panels. And like corporations, we're like, we've got an away day, we need someone to kind of bring a little bit of light and energy, or we need someone to come and talk, like interview a serious subject out of somebody. So it's nice that I've been able to show like my breadth.
Yeah.
My range, darling, my range.
What do you predict will happen with it? You know, are we only growing? It's grown a lot since you started your podcast. Like, where's the future of podcasting?
Such a good question, Alice, and I genuinely don't know. And I'll be really honest with you, I think even if you sat down with some of the bigger podcasters, I don't know as if they would necessarily know either. But I did last year, and you might have felt the same way, started to feel the heat of lots of people starting to podcast. And I very firmly believe there's room for everybody. So if anyone ever messages me and says, how do I start a podcast? I will tell them what I did. And I've got a blog page on my website that lists all the equipment I used, the costs, everything. Because I also think if I withheld that information, then that would show that I didn't have confidence in my output. It's kind of a weird thing. But I will tell anyone what kit I use. I give them any advice. I put them in touch with people. Like, I have no issue with that. But you obviously... a celebrity starts a podcast with a similar topic to what you're doing, they are going to beat you in the charts. So you are going to see the impact of that. You might not see your numbers change necessarily, but you're going to see other people perhaps attracting new listeners that you're not going to reach because they have a celebrity profile or whatever it might be.
How important are the charts?
My other podcasting mates that I talk to, we all agree no one looks at podcasting charts other than podcasters. Okay. But I don't really look at them because, again, I'm not a big fish.
Yeah.
Why do that to myself? I mean, hashtag triggered.
But so just back to celebrities, they might acquire new listeners, but there is still space for everyone.
So there is room for everybody. So if somebody who's got a million followers on Instagram starts a podcast, they are going to probably get great listens right off the bat. I'm really happy that I grew an audience literally from nothing. When I published I published three podcasts first in like the space of 2 days.
And you're at 5 million, is that right? Did I get 5 million from somewhere?
in the last just under 2 years, it's like 4,100,000 and something, which would imply that because it's 4 years old, that there's another spot of like probably less than probably half of that, so 6 to 7 million. But it's all analytics aren't as transparent on podcasting as they are on YouTube, and because I haven't been with the same provider all that time, I cannot tell you. I'm sort of added it up from like when I published through Squarespace, then when I published through Libsyn, now publishing through Acast. So I'm sort of patchworking my total figures.
What kind of transparency, what do you think the platforms need to improve? Is it that isn't as good as, say, the YouTube analytics? They're obviously younger, so.
This is a really good point. And I think one of the big things is with YouTube, people are looking at it and the hyperlinks, whether they are affiliate or not, are there. And so whilst engaging in that video, you can click and then the brand and the content creator know, can measure if that video has generated a sale or a click through. But with podcasting, I could be walking down the street, and I've done this and I'm guilty of it. I can be walking down the street or I can be at my computer and I'll listen to something and I'll Google it.
Yeah.
So it's a very broken track and there's absolutely nothing. I don't believe there is a way of then, and even if you were at the point of sale, how did you hear about this? Mm. You have to rely on the person going from the Emma Gunn show. Or
yeah, I literally heard it.
So I don't think there is necessarily a way that you can complete that loop with podcasting. But again,
what about if you had some sort of audio tracking device that you subscribe to the podcast and then any products that were mentioned in that automatically get put into a list and emailed to you? So afterwards, I know that Amazon are doing some stuff with video. And I think that that's going to be really interesting as a competitor to YouTube. But they've got these creator fronted pages now on Amazon, and when with their kind of video and Amazon Prime etc, that they'll be able to have creators upload videos, and then I reckon that automatically everything that they've talked about will be in your basket already, and then you can like under that's just a prediction.
That's a bit like waking up and having the U2 album on your phone though, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
I don't know. Maybe. I'm not necessarily sure about how that's going to go, but
do you think it's more than brands need to be thinking about podcasting as a great way, but maybe just not as trackable, and maybe for sort of brand awareness rather than, I think people are getting a bit obsessed with kind of click-throughs and that return
people
on investment.
People like stats.
Yeah.
Because you know, if you've got the stats, you can spend the money. It's as simple as that. I work with a lot of big companies on the other side of things, and I know what questions are asked in the board meetings. So I do completely understand. But this is why it's worth looking to the US, because if the US ad revenue spend is this big in podcasting and they're moving budget away from other media platforms into podcasting, it tells you something. And it tells you something even more significant because it can't be as easily measured as it can with the others. But it's clearly having an impact. So I don't know. Again, we are that much behind the US that we're just kind of going to have to see how it plays out a bit.
That must be pretty exciting.
Obviously, I would rely on my listeners, every listener, subscribing to my newsletter, but I'm just thinking, if I created a newsletter and then every week when the podcast went out I put a link to everything to buy.
Well, I suppose it depends in what kind of, it might be useful.
To I put it in the show notes, but do you find that people find it's hard to find the show notes?
But I just remember that I was interviewing Lorna Lux.
Oh, I like Lorna.
Yeah, she's great. And it was to do with Instagram stories. And I think this was past our interview. I must have just been looking at it. But it's like, if I don't link to something, then my DMs are filled with people asking me where I can get it from. So it's not actually me just trying to make as much money from affiliates. It's because otherwise I'm going to be on my DMs for ages. So,
yeah, totally. I get that.
What are your views on affiliate marketing?
People have to make a living creating this content, and that is a way of making money. And I know a couple of friends of mine have sort of done Instagram stories where they've said, okay, let's talk about it. Do you get annoyed when I do an ad? And I've monetized my Instagram and I do affiliate link swipe ups. Not loads, because I'm not that organized. But I feel as if I'm driving a sale and the brand has made an affiliate link available, then it's kind of daft of me not to use it. But I wouldn't, for example, because there are those websites. I wouldn't go onto a website, right, see what's got the highest commission and then just do that and say I loved it. So I think that's always been my thing of, if I swipe up to something, it's because I really like it. These leopard print boots, I was obsessed with these and I kept putting them on my Insta stories because I was like, I can't believe, I love these boots so much. And so I did an affiliate link. But I honestly, the amount of people who were like, oh God, Emma and her leopard print boots, because I'm obsessed with them.
I think actually Lydia Mullen was saying affiliate links allow you to not take the brand deals that you don't want to do, because it's just like a constant of, this is stuff that I'm already buying and recommending.
Yeah.
Finally, where would you like your podcast to be in a year, 2 years time?
On Oprah's top podcast list.
I thought you didn't care about charts.
That's not a chart, that's no. Oprah.
Yeah, fair.
I just want to honestly continue in the vein that I've been going. And I think sort of to touch a little bit on what we were talking about earlier about the space getting really crowded. I remember a friend of mine saying to me, people can talk about beauty, people can do podcasts, they can literally rip off your content and create shows about all the subjects that you've done, but they just can't have you in there because you're the exclusive, like you're the only thing. So, and I feel the same about my listeners. I feel like it has been a collaborative project. And I always say, what do you want me to talk about? Who do you want me to get on the show? And so I work really hard to make sure that the content's true to me, but will also cater to what they want. So I just want to keep doing that genuinely. I feel really proud of having grown this. Like I said, from, I think when I started, I didn't even have 2,000 Instagram followers, and growing to what it is now, I feel really proud of that. And I just, as much as I'm sure it feels really, really lovely when you've got millions of subscribers and followers and what have you, I really love having the audience that I have who are engaged and care and give a shit and feedback really nice things or give me constructive criticism. So if I can just keep doing this, I'd be so happy.
Is there one person that you hear time and time again from your audience that they would love you to interview? And then on that, if you could have one person in the world that you would really like to interview on your show, who would it be?
So actually, funnily, what's really funny is that the people that I get asked to get back on again and again and again and again are Caroline Hirons, Trini Woodall and Nadine Baggett, because I did a podcast with all three of them and it was like herding kittens, and I did need a sleep and a lie down afterwards. But
I love Caroline.
They are my friends and they are brilliant, brilliant women who are brilliant in so many wonderful different ways. And I love hanging out with them all together and separately. And I just think the audience really, really loved that. Listeners really, really enjoyed it. So whenever I say, who would you like me to get on? They're like, get Caroline, Nadine and Trini back on, which is quite funny because I have all of their numbers. But what I'm really keen to do is to, not just for my listeners, but for me, is to push myself. And so one of the things I say about the podcast is I chat with people who are smarter than me so we can all learn. And everybody has a great story and everybody is really inspirational. But the people that I'm really desperate to get on at the moment, like for me, sitting down with Arnold Schwarzenegger would be a dream come true, because that guy was a skinny Austrian poor boy who turned himself into the strongest man in the world, became one of the richest guys in Hollywood and married into the Kennedys. I need to know how he did that.
Yeah.
I want to unpick that story. And he started a demolition company where he went and with brute strength knocked over walls. Like, I mean, the guy I could literally recite his entire book to you. He's just really fascinating. I would love
to. Is it Game Changers that he's on Netflix talking about his?
Well, that one, let's put a pin in that, because that has been really, really controversial. I think he was one of the producers. Because that's all about plant-based diet.
I haven't watched it myself.
Definitely park that for another day. I would also really love to get Tom Cruise on the podcast, because the guy's work ethic just blows my mind. Every film that he's done where he's had to learn a skill, he has been taught by the best in the world and then has eventually been better than them. So when he did Colour of Money, he became a better pool player than all of the like world-class pool players. And when he was a pilot in Top Gun, he became a pilot. So in the new Top Gun movie that comes out later this year, when you see him flying the planes, it's all him.
There's some serious method acting.
Yeah, but I find that really interesting that he can be that kind of, that he can be that focused and he can learn and he can adapt, but he can bring people with him.
Yeah. Didn't he break his ankle doing one of his own stunts?
In London, this fair city, not far from here.
Yeah. and then carried on.
And that was the take that they used in the actual final film, as one of him breaking his ankle. But in that film, which is Mission Impossible 6, he gets into a helicopter and he goes, I don't know how to fly this thing. And it's like, Tom Cruise does, but his character didn't.
Yeah.
I find that extraordinary. Like the most incredible super spy in the world, and he's better at doing things than he is. So I would really love to unpick all of that.
You need one more then. You've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, you've got Tom Cruise, who would be your third and final.
My third and final. It would probably be someone like Tina Turner or Dolly Parton. In fact, no, it's Dolly.
Yeah, she's incredible. She was going to... Elvis wanted to buy the rights to one of her songs, and she said no and was really worried about it. And then actually...
Well, he wanted to record... I Will Always Love You, and it was all scheduled for him to come in, and they said, oh, but in order for him to do that, you have to sell him the publishing rights. And she said, I can't do that. And that was I Will Always Love You, that obviously Whitney Houston went on to make incredibly famous. Dolly's really smart,
like
the boundaries she sets with people, because actually if you think about it, you know very little about Dolly. You don't know what she thinks, you don't know what she thinks politically, you don't know much about her friendships, so she tells you what she wants you to know, and I find that really, really fascinating. And I just also think that when you look at her body of work, she's been creating music, really relevant music, for a long time, incredible storytelling. And I don't think she's got the recognition she deserves. I really, really don't. I mean, don't get me wrong, she lives a good life. But I don't think people really understand what a genius she is.
Well, fingers crossed we can get her.
Yeah, so Arnie, Tom and Dolly.
Perfect. A big thanks to Emma for coming on the show.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogosphere-magazine.com. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?